Welcome to ZMO Kitchen Talks, a podcast about historical and anthropological research in the Middle East, Africa, Eurasia, South and Southeast Asia, produced by Leibniz Zentrum Moderner Orient in Berlin. My name is Elisa Nobel-Dilati. I'm a Middle East anthropologist and knowledge transfer officer at ZMO. Over a cup of coffee or tea, I talk to renowned academics about their research questions, regions, and methodologies. We also take a look behind the scenes of academic practice at personal reflections, challenges, failures, and unexpected outcomes. Welcome to a new episode of ZMO Kitchen Talks. In today's episode, we dive into the broader theme of Islam and feminism in Turkey. But more specifically, we look at a certain Sufi order called the Rifa'i order that was founded in the late 19th century. And what makes this group special is that it is led by an unveiled woman, by Sheikha Jamal Nur Sargut, who leads men and women alike. And I'm very happy to introduce our guest, Dr. Feyza Burak Atli, who is a postdoctoral researcher at the Department of Anthropology at Northwestern University in Evanston, Illinois, and currently a guest researcher at ZMO. And Feyza has done extensive research on this Sufi group since 2011. So hi, Feyza, and thank you for coming.
Hi, Eliza. Thank you so much for having me.
Let me just introduce you briefly. You are a social anthropologist and you specialize at the intersection of religion, gender and class. And your research focuses on the ethical self-formation of Muslim women influenced by Sufism, Islamic feminism and female religious authority in Turkey. And in your research, you use a number of research methods, including ethnographic fieldwork, participant observation, historical genealogy, and discourse analysis, all approached from a critical decolonial feminist perspective. Your dissertation, Trajectories of Modern Sufism, an ethno-historical study of the Rifa'i order and modern social change in Turkey, offers deep insights into these dynamics. And additionally, you are working on an ethnographic book project at the moment titled Other Muslim Women, Alternative Politics of Piety, Feminism, and Class in Turkey. Feyza, I'm very excited for our conversation, and we're going to look not only at the teachings of the Sheikha, but also behind the scenes of your research, your experience in the field, and some reflections. And maybe I will begin with a very personal question first. How did you develop an interest in Islamic feminism?
Well, looking back, I think I formulated my anthropological questions in high school, maybe over 20 years ago, such as what is Islam, what is secularism, what is feminism? And not because I was such a philosophically oriented kid or political kid, but I was put under conditions of these two different ideological camps in Turkey. One of them was the Kemalist secularist state. The other one was the Muslim communities or the Islamists. And I was in this interesting position because I was raised by a very pious family in a very secularist neighborhood. So what happened was the Kemalist state in the 90s banned the veil, the headscarf. And so we were start to be chased by the campus police when I was in college. I had to take it off. So it was kind of a traumatizing experience for a 20, 21-year-old girl. But what also happened there is that the Turkish feminists get together against the Islamist woman, what they called as Islamist woman. So rather than being in solidarity with women who were protesting in front of the campus to get, for their basic rights to access to education with their headscarf, they really aligned with the state. So that moment kind of strained the relationship between Islam and feminism even more. So while this was happening, I was also going to an Islamic school called Imam Hatip Lisesi, which is a preachers and imam school. And they couldn't make a preacher out of me, as you can see. But the curriculum there and the people who were attending the school were, you know, all shades of Muslim communities that composed that Islamic revival in Turkey. And one thing that was kind of bringing them together was this conservative gender norms. It was always a patriarchal interpretation of Islam. So I had really big problems with that too. So I was a troublemaker for the Muslim community. I was a troublemaker for the feminist community. So I was always lost in these conversations, and who I am, why don't I fit? I was not convinced by either sides because they were both very normative. So I ended up studying English and American literature. And while I was doing that, I focused on women writers. As I was studying these different forms of feminism, I realized that, especially like when I was studying Black feminism or third world feminism, I had this moment, I knew it. There's not one kind of feminism. I knew it. And that was also the moment like, no, I'm going to find this Islamic feminism. And that's how I then turned into from literature to anthropology.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you for sharing this personal story also. I'm wondering what brought you then to the Rifa'i group? And how did you get to know the Sheikha Cemal Nur?
That was in 2005 in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. She was visiting UNC Chapel Hill and Duke University as a guest lecturer. I was also familiar with the idea of female religious authorities leading on the women, because my mother and my grandmother was also preachers for Diyanet, for the Directorate of Religious Affairs in Turkey. But of course, that comes with that certain image. It's also conservative gender norms, right? But then Cemal Nur came and she was wearing a very bohemian, very colorful dresses with nail polish and makeup and, you know, hairdo. She's not only a woman Sheikha, she's also unveiled woman Sheikha. And she's also leading men. And there's no gender segregation here. So first, I was a bit shocked, but also intrigued. How come? And years later, when I started to work on Islamic feminism, I just remembered her and I just gave her a call and she welcomed me. And then the fieldwork started in 2011. When I talked to the Sheikha herself, she was always downplaying her gender identity because, you know, in the Sufi kind of philosophy, the murshid, the perfect human being, the master, is supposed to be genderless or post-gender because, you know, her ego and worldly things are already been shed. And so she was saying, you know, don't see me, my body, but my teachings, you know, I'm just like a channel for these teachings. So my gender does not make any difference. And then as I was like getting more into these questions and like kind of getting frustrated, what do I do here? Then it really hit me that the way they were accommodating their mystical, spiritual, and Islamic sensibilities with secular socialities that we associate in Turkey with a certain westernized secular neighborhood. So there was this dissonance. When people think of Sufi orders, they don't think of secular socialities. And I was like, okay, what is Islam for them then? What is religion, religiosity? What is secularism and secularity for them? How do they enact and inhabit and transform religiosity and secularity in novel ways? And what does this tell us about how we perceived secularism in Turkey? So I changed into the topic of entanglement of secular and the religious, making their life, words, pious subjectivities or moral communities, how it was entangled in the process.
Great. So can you tell us what is the Rifa'i order? What are their teachings about?
Mm-hmm. So the Rifa'i order, the Rifa'i branch that I worked on, was founded at the end of 19th century by Sheikh Kenan Rifa'i. What was really interesting about Sheikh Rifa'i was he had dual career. One of them was a Sufi Sheikh. The other one is being a high-level bureaucrat in the Ministry of Modern Education. So he was, on the one hand, modernizer for modern education, you know, in the Ottoman Empire, going from one territory to another, building new schools, public schools, for all Muslim and non-Muslim students to be under, you know, Ottoman public schooling. So on the other hand, he was a Sufi. And these things today is still like kind of considered as incompatible. But he was kind of bringing them together. And in his Sufi order, he started as a salon meetings. And he had non-Muslim followers, women followers. It was a very mixed group, like a very Ottoman cosmopolitan upper society group doing Sufi music or Sufi discussions. And then it was the time of Abdul Hamid II, and he got suspicious about this kind of quote-unquote secret meetings. So Abdul Hamid said, if you want to be a Sufi sheikh, you need to build an actual lodge, Sufi lodge, what we call tekke, and register it in the ministry or like the assembly of sheikhs, you know, be a stately affirmed sheikh. So he had to go through that ritualistic, the ceremonial, the space, tekke, the lodge, for almost 18 years. But then come the republic. And in 1925, the new republic banned, actually, the Sufi orders altogether as part of a larger secularization process and reforms. And we always imagine, like the Turks or in the literature, that the Sufis were in opposition to that because they were being, right, like suppressed literally. But then we see Kenan Rifai as pro-ban. He was actually endorsing the ban, and he was saying Sufi orders are corrupted at this point, and it is more about ceremonies, but they're empty now. It is never about the mystical knowledge anymore or spirituality anymore. So he kind of signaled a post-tariqa, post-order, Sufi order Sufism, right? Because in the beginning, there was no brotherhoods. So he was like, let's get back to those days. And another interesting thing he did is that he's, while he, you know, canceled all the ceremonial rituals like zikr, like sama, all these, you know, Sufi practices, but he also readily reformed the Islamic gender norms too. Again, like he had many unveiled women, very highly educated women in the 20s as his followers. And they also then extended the public participation of women to the leadership positions. And in 1950, when he passed away, Samiha Ayverdi, another sheikha, took over. And she kind of steered the Rifai order in a very different direction this time. It was the Cold War era. It was the era where left and right was, you know, having political violence towards each other, and it was very rough time. So she kind of aligned with the far right conservative nationalists back in that day, because she also thought the Turkish culture was lost. So for her, Sufism then become a thing to preserve Turkish cultural heritage, which is Ottoman Islamic heritage. And so for her, it was all about building some new NGOs about cultural preservation in a very nationalist form. And then in 2000s, Cemal Nur Sargut took over after Ayverdi died also. And Cemal Nur, it lives in this neoliberal, globalized Turkey. And her followers is very different than Samiha Ayverdi's followers. Although from the beginning they were upper middle class, being an upper class has changed so much for these three periods. And for Samiha Ayverdi period, it was the being a bureaucrat, being working for state, you know, have cultural capital, be a musician, be an artist. Whereas here now in New Turkey, it is really about wealth, its actual capital, and having a globalized cosmopolitan lifestyle, you know, travel abroad and have education abroad, those kind of, you know, upper class privileged things. So because she is now addressing that kind of a population, she started to use their language. So, for instance, she to teach Sufism, she would use movies, cinema, or she would again do this academic enterprises to attract them as a legitimate, you know. No, Sufism is no longer this backward, this ignorant lower class, or all this stigma that was attached to it when it was banned. No, look at now you can come to university, college, and you can get a certificate. Or if you want, you can get a master's or a PhD degrees in Sufi studies.
Yeah, super interesting. I have many more questions. Maybe I can start in the ban of Sufi groups at first, but then nowadays, the Rifa'i group being very popular or even having a growing popularity. Maybe you can say a few words about the perception in Turkey.
So that's a very good question, and it doesn't have an easy answer. But perceived by who is the question. So there is a part of mainstream Muslims. It doesn't have to be the fundamentals or Orthodox, just the mainstream Diyanet, or regular traditional Muslims, they do not accept the fact that a woman can be unveiled and a woman can be a sheikah. So for them, it is already blasphemy. But of course, they cannot do anything about it because Turkey is a secular country. We don't have any Sharia or blasphemy laws. So there's always this kind of backlash to her. But on the other hand, there's a huge middle class community who are really sick of polarization between the secularists and the Islamists. The people I interviewed, they always said, you know, what they really liked in this field was because it was a very unifying spirit. And, you know, ex-secularists, they wanted to have some sort of spirituality, but they would never go towards, you know, a gender conservative lifestyle. So they find a safe haven with her to practice Islam without necessarily changing the lifestyle. And many ex-Islamists or like other Sharia-oriented tariqa people also came and they said, they were sick of this ritualistic, this external religiosity, formalistic religiosity, and the obsession with the details about that. Now it is more about the meanings and what Sufism stands for, ethical and spiritual levels of Sufism. So they also like are escaping from some kind of dry religiosity. So this group, which is not small, love Cemal Nur because of that.
Yeah, so from what you're saying, I get that she is also, she's embodying the pious and the secular in a way, and also maybe bridging different groups. And I find that interesting because she has actually, like, one of her set goals is according to her, she wants to bridge East and West through Sufism. And you have mentioned that you met her in the US in a university context. And she's actually, going very international. She has an international visibility. So I'm wondering, why does she have this transnational approach?
I think it is for a couple of reasons. One of them is that Sufism has been globalized in the early 2000s. It was a global trend. And so she kind of capitalized on that moment. Also, the prestige of Sufism in the West brought back the prestige of Sufism in Turkey. Otherwise, Sufism was the kind of, you know, stigmatized category, like superstition and backward orders, like secrecy, you know, God knows what's happening in there. That kind of always this news about in the 90s about this corrupted Sufi orders. But then once Rumi became a UNESCO heritage in 2007, for instance, then it became okay to talk about Rumi in Turkey as well. So there was this reverse prestige, as I mentioned before. And the other thing is there was a rising Islamophobia, right, in the 2001 and after 9/11 and everything. So for her, there was an urgency to fight Islamophobia around the world. And for that to happen, Sufism is the only kind of teaching that can unite everyone because it accepts everyone. But then she found some funding from one of her wealthy businessmen who lived in New York, who wanted to endow a chair in the US, and they do it in the name of Kenan Rifa'i. So once that happened, the Sufi studies professors, they are very prominent. They also introduced her to others. And then the next thing I know, that was in China and in Japan and then in Turkey. So I think by bringing all this to the Turkey, and now she's teaching in this academic institution, Üsküdar University, she effectively bypassed the male authority of Diyanet and the Divinity School theologians. She opened up herself a separate and alternative space rather than stepping onto theirs. And now she's doing it in a kind of a more legitimate, quote unquote, because it's a university, secular university, and more modern, and it appeals to modern people going to university, right? Then there is no suspicion anymore about this exclusive, secret brotherhood kind of, myths or cults. So I think transnational also happened because of, you know, this global moment, but also because of how to legitimize her authority and how to legitimize Sufism in Turkey through making it the world tradition.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, coming to your academic research, I mean, we've tapped into so many topics already, but maybe a very explicit question. What are your main contributions in the field of anthropology?
I think the main contribution I wanted to make is, one, I wanted to say something about what is Islam, the question, what is Islam? And it has been asked since Talal Asad, actually even before him, and we had different anthropological answers to that question. And, the one trend was saying Islam is a discursive tradition, which means it is coming from sacred texts. Quran and Hadith and Sharia law. It is an embodied, visibly, publicly visible, bodily rituals are most important thing in Islamic world. And you have to do those things in order to become a Muslim, like veil and pray, and which contradicted the secular liberal sensibilities, especially in the Western countries. So this study is kind of juxtaposed an Islam with a vis-a-vis a West. And at the time when, you know, we have so much Muslim immigrants in Western countries and going through some sort of racism, I think it was a good move to show at least where these people are coming from. I really appreciated that. But what bothered me was at the end is that this kind of disciplinarian, very external religiosity became the Islam in the academia. Oh, there's a different grammar, as Asad would say, through Wittgenstein, than liberal secular grammar. So it was always like in contrasting way. And what I did, I wanted to show that there are internal differences within Islam itself as a tradition. And so this can be a serious ontological differences too, which means Islam does not have one grammar. And I don't think secularity has one grammar either. So there are multiple grammars within that. And I also wanted to show a very variety of convergences between them with different historical trajectories. So I said, Islam is not a discursive tradition only. Islam is a tradition marked by ethical plurality. So that ethical plurality meant a couple of things. One, the sources of piety is not just the Quran. It can be moral exemplars, for instance, like the sheikh and sheikhas. And then the context really determines, not even determines, but inform seriously how to interpret an Islamic text or Islamic rules, and historical context, you know, social context, and also the habitus of people who are actually living Islam, the practitioners, and their intersectional identities. To me, the Rifa'i Sufi Islam was not some sort of abstract teaching, you know. I think it was really recalibrated by each sheikh and sheikha through the lens of an upper class gendered lens. And also because each three period was different. Although in Turkey, right, we are talking about the same tradition, same country, but different periods, that it changes radically. It also shows how much the political context, how you respond to political context, how you create new forms of living Sufism under the new conditions of possibility. So according to these things, the way they said, okay, let's practice selfless service, for instance, as a Sufi thing, it will change its forms all the time. For Samiha Ayverdi, you need to go and open up new civil society associations to protect cultural heritage, Turkish cultural heritage, Ottoman cultural heritage. So she was very nationalistic in that sense. Whereas for Cemal Nur, you need to go abroad and open up new Sufi research institutes to fight against Islamophobia. So selfless service, let's say this is the principle of Sufism, is the same, but the shapes it takes is completely different from one another. That's why context and habitus really matters. And the other thing was the intersection of class with secularity as well. Secularism as a political doctrine is one thing, you know, separation of church and state or privatization of religion. But also it's a social episteme. And when I say social episteme, it's like some sort of disenchantment of the world, that certain lifestyles and certain religiosities are okay, not the others. So secularity, kind of secular power, is creating all this acceptable lifestyles of religion. And that was also Assadian main argument. In Turkey, it was also like that too, in a slightly different way. Cultural norms are really politicized as secular or Islamic. And now that we are seeing that, you know, it was never about the cultural norms or like Islam or secularity, but it was really about the lifestyles of a certain class of people. In the late Ottoman Empire and the early Republic, these people were always upper class. Their lives were already, as a logical imperialism brings, it was westernized. It was already part of Europe. And but they never saw it as something clashing with their Muslim identity. And then this alignment with the class and the way they understand and approach Islam and also secularity was very, very different. And I was like, okay, so these people, on the one hand, do the cultural norms that are, really associated with the secular Turks. But then they are really believing in an enchanted world. And then I realized these are Sufis who has this notion of batin and zahir, the external and the internal, right? So they really care about the batini aspects of religiosity, your inner subjectivity, your, rather than external religiosity. Then I realized that this can also be applied to their understanding of secularity. While they can observe the zahiri, the external, the visible secularity, such as no gender segregation or, love of Atatürk or whatever it is, politicized as a secular lifestyle in Turkey. But when it comes to the batini, the inner aspect of secularism, which is boils down to disenchantment, they don't abide by it. So there's not one kind of secularity that we can just theorize, right? This is really context-based and people-based and making it plural and multiple. And it is interesting because when you look at the most Islamist group right now today, they are the opposite. They take the batini aspect of secularity, which is positivist idea of religion. So now Islam became a religion of rationality, of reason, right? But they did not take the zahiri elements of secularity, which is the Western clothing or gender norms or stuff like that. So although they look more Islamic, quote unquote, with their, beards or clothing maybe. But on the other hand, their approach to religion and secularity was pretty much borrowed by the modern secular episteme. And in my case, we have this very westernized, secular-looking woman and men in Turkey, but they do not abide by the idea of religion as a rational thing. No, Sufism is a way of life, way of being, way of knowing in the world. It is an everyday life.
Mm-hmm. Your research also tackles gender studies, I think. Mm-hmm. So, here I think I need to ask you, would you call the Sheikha a feminist? Would she call herself a feminist? Or what would she call herself?
Yeah, thank you for asking that. So eventually in my book, one of my book chapters, we'll tackle this question. And I did come back during the field work, the idea of Islamic feminism and whether she is one, she can be considered one or not. So a couple of things. She does not identify actively as a feminist, right? She doesn't say, I'm a feminist, Sufi, or either Islamic feminist or feminist. And the difference is that Islamic feminist, I guess I need to first define what it is and how is it different than secular feminism. Well, Islamic feminists, their demands are feminist in nature, but their source of legitimacy is Islamic, the Quran, the Hadith, and they want to change the interpretation of Islam itself to fight for gender equality, for instance, not just the change of laws, from secular, from religious to secular laws. It's more deeper than that. But she doesn't want to go there. And first, I thought it was a quietist attitude. I mean, she's already dealing so much backlash as a female Sufi, leader. So it made sense to me that she is not bringing another controversy to the public. And when you say I'm a feminist, and there's a certain connotations that comes with the history of feminism. Some of them would say, "Oh, that's a Western invention." Then they will accuse her again with inauthenticity in terms of her Islam, and also because of the divisive nature of Turkish history of Turkish feminism, it was really a contentious subject between the Muslim woman and the secularist Kemalist woman. So first, I thought really there's a political strategy of non-confrontation, of quietism, and how to navigate these things. And then I asked her, over and over again for 9-10 years in different contexts whenever it comes up. And she said, this is all about her. She gave me some Sufi answers, right? Like one of them is that, Feyza, Sufism is all about unification. It unifies. Ism, any identity politics is divisive by nature because it is the politics of difference. So one, I cannot be a feminist per se because of that. And secondly, she is a Sufi master. She has to welcome everyone, which includes the misogynist man, for instance, right? And she says, they are supposed to be transformed into a better human being in my guidance. So if I say I'm a feminist, if I put that kind of a, standard, then
your label,
then non-feminist people are not welcomed. Mm-hmm. Whereas she really has to welcome everyone. But then, she will also say, women are much closer to God. They have greater capacity of spirituality. And her teachings has very feminist ideas about patriarchy is un-Islamic by nature because it is not just. And a man's treatment to his wife or just other women in general shows a degree of his piety in the Sufi path. And also there's this divine feminine teaching of Ibn Arabi that she teaches too, which is every creation has a feminine and masculine within them. So it is not necessarily hierarchical, but it's complementary. So it's an element. And then the feminine one is actually something that you need to achieve. So a man can achieve the status of being a feminine level, rank, but a woman may not. So it was not biologically essential. So there are so many things that you can say, this is an interpretation that really falls down to the category of Islamic feminism. But then, she's not going there. So what I said in my study is that she is doing feminism by enacting it, by embodying it, by living it every day as a moral exemplar. So she is a non-discursive, non-discursive-wise, non-activist, but embodied feminist, Islamic feminist, that really becomes a role model for so many Muslim women.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, finally, let's talk some methodology and positionality, very important topics for anthropologists. How did you navigate being a researcher from an American university at one side, while at the same time being a Turkish woman yourself?
That's a very good question that I'm still reflecting upon. There were some advantages and some disadvantages, of course, to being a native, for some native speaker, right? I didn't have the language barrier. I didn't have the barrier for cultural codes, that I understand the metaphors, you know, so this nuances. It was my history too, my country, my culture. But again, you know, there was so much that I had to unlearn. Because you go into the field saying, I know everything about Islam that there is to be, you know, like I'm a Muslim woman. I studied this all my life. I know everything. Then you realize, you know, not everything or, you know, some things in a very different ways. And so you have to unlearn things to open up new possibilities, new interpretations. And that's not easy, you know. Again, like for me, it took a while to... for me to come to the point that, you know, the headscarf is not obligation for a woman. And I was resenting them for it in the beginning, right? Because I suffered so much to hold on to it in Turkey. I'm traumatized so much by the state. Whereas I cannot imagine like being a spiritual Muslim woman, but not going through that trauma. It just felt so unfair. In the beginning, but the more I worked on Islamic feminism, now I have a very different relationship to my headscarf. But I went through stages at least. So there's that. I think if you're a native ethnographer, you need to be ready to unlearn, to relearn again. And for any ethnographer, I think my biggest advice is to be themselves. I think what I did good was just be transparent. I wasn't this mysterious researcher from somewhere. They knew me. They knew my family. I become kind of friends with them. So that kind of transparency in my life, sharing my own life as well with them, which was, I think, only fair when you're asking such deep questions. Especially about like meaning that they don't even want to talk to their husbands or like some other people. It's very private. Then you really need to get their trust, and the rapport is very important. And they will never give it to any estranged ethnographer, you know. They will just give the very surface level answers. But to go deep, you need to live with them. You need to be yourself while you are living with them, and let them see your weaknesses, your strengths, you know. Just as a human being.
Yeah. Just come as a human.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you, Feyza, for sharing all of these insights with us. And I really enjoyed our conversation.
Thank you so much for having me.